This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 505, AR Never Neverland. Welcome again to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin, one of your co-hosts. Our other co-host, Andy Piper, we think might be enjoying an extra hour of spring ahead because we've changed times here on this side of the ocean and he hasn't on his side. Michael just came to that conclusion. I bet you're right, Michael. Yeah. How are you?
I am doing well. I'm excited about this week's show. And yeah, that we were sitting there going, where's Andy? And it's like, bing.
Yep.
Because that was last weekend, and I know there's a period of time where the US and the UK are shifted wrong.
Yes.
And then it'll shift back together again. And I just can't remember if he was first or if we were first. And right now, either way, it's wrong.
Yeah. You know, we don't cross the threads, and it could very well be he had his meeting notice or an alarm on his calendar for his time, like he's supposed to, like exactly when. But anyway.
You would think that technology would handle this. It's not like there's this hard problem that's been really intractable to solve, like, you know, like dealing with Siri intents and things of that nature and approving Siri on device.
Well, yeah. So exactly. This very first article deals with all of this from the 9 to 5 Mac example, where we're talking about how John Gruber is not happy that Siri is not doing the things it should do from an agentic perspective. And, you know, answer a question like, hey, when should I go pick up mom from the airport? Should be able to interrogate your calendar, should be interrogating your email, should interrogate.
Well, they showed it at WWDC in 2024, right?
Well,
that was fine.
But it's hard. You know, this is hard stuff. It's not that simple.
Difference between a demo and actually delivery. It's actually interesting about this because last weekend I was at a virtual conference for the day and called Unwrapped Live. And this is a conference that focuses on a deep technical topic for Swift developers. They do it once a year. There are probably 600 to 800 people online for this. I mean, it was fantastic, and I really enjoy it each year.
Was there a good collaboration space for you guys to kind of, you know?
There is. They have a Slack. It's the way the conference works each year is one topic. Last year, I think it was Swift data. Mm-hmm. I'll have to go back in my notes, but doesn't really matter. This year, it was App Intents.
Oh,
and okay. I had added.
Well, you've got lots of experience on that.
To wasted time years ago using Siri intents. And Apple last year at WWDC changed it to App intents. And none of my Siri intents are working right now. And I really haven't had time to get them to work. Mm. And there's language translation issue and all kinds of stuff. So this was perfectly timely for me because I want to do this. And I actually want to add App intents to my current card tracker application, and I have another app in mind that I'm working on some early designs for that App Intents would be really good for. Now, what's really interesting, though, is part of the session was, this is what Apple's been wanting you to do since last June.
And you haven't done it.
And the APIs are not yet stable.
Oh, okay, well.
Okay, yeah. And one of the big things about the promise of improved Siri and Apple Intelligence on device, having access to all your data locally on the device to be able to answer the question, what time should I go to the airport to pick up mom, blah, 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 and is there a good coffee shop along the way?
Right.
Right?
Yep.
That one of the key enablers of that is for developers to enable App Intents in their applications. So we've got this two-pronged problem going on. One, so as you said,
developers.
It's really hard.
Yes.
It's really hard. Two, and the APIs aren't ready. So I was actually not surprised at all that it wasn't happening in 18.4. And I've been playing around with that beta for, about 3 or 4 weeks now. Mm-hmm. So when what's his name from Bloomberg mentioned this a couple of weeks ago that it wasn't happening, when the rumored new home device with a screen was pushed off and wasn't happening. And then I actually listened to a deep dive interview with Gruber on being ticked off that it wasn't happening. None of that was surprising to me. And you can see this rumored home device would really need App Intents working successfully and on-device Apple Intelligence working successfully to make it the vision that everybody was talking about. So I'd rather they get it right than deliver a crappy solution. However, I can see as a pundit being mad that they showed us a demo and said it would be within a year.
Yeah, well, I'll drag out my tiny violin for all this. Again, it's hard. This is not simple stuff. And now that you've explained it really well, that migrating to App Intents was the way to unlock all these things. So you could do all that on device and have the privacy and security and all the things that you need to have, because you don't want random, you know, spiders, certainly not me, crawling around your email and your text messages and your calendar and such. It's not simple.
And well, not only that, from a security perspective, even let's say everyone had App Intents ready and the App Intents API was ready. Mm-hmm. Think about the security issues. If I can string App Intents together and I have a conversational AI on my device where I can say, pretend I'm Michael Martin and dot, 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 fill in the blanks, string together all this data on my device.
Sure.
And do something.
Sure.
Right? So it's not just it's App Intents, it's security, it's data privacy, it's all this stuff kind of coming to a head. And as you started with, and it's hard.
And it's hard. Yeah. So you got to get the security right no matter what. And yeah. You know, our friends over at Humane probably encountered one or two of these same things, you know, as they were dealing with their particular device. Now, our friends at Netflix have done something a little bit similar, and there was a really intriguing article I saw from Vice, not from The Verge, but another V, you know, place. And what this one did is it said,
very interesting.
Yeah, if you look at some of the content that they have used AI to upscale. And if you watch the video to see how the upscaling works, you know, you're taking content that was not recorded in 4K, but it looks like it's 4K until you pay a little bit more attention to, you know, certain key things like teeth, fingers, backgrounds, text, which again, you would think, you know, we should have flying cars by now, and we should be able from an AI perspective to read text, upscale text, and have the text read the same thing. But well, apparently not.
So this is another interesting one, and I had a slightly different reaction, but I think we come to the same result ultimately. First off, the article specifically talked about a TV show that, did you watch A Different World?
No, not much.
I did. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun show, and it was. I was at the right age for that show when it came out, et cetera. Now, this isn't really surprising. You said it was filmed at an extremely low resolution because it was the late 80s, yep. Right? I think 360p was, you know, high resolution at the time. And I think the issue here is because, you know, Amazon upscales also for Amazon Prime. Others upscale, and it's usually okay. Maybe not perfect, but pretty good. And to me, this is an example of laziness. Lazy programmers who just said, hey, take that stream, upscale it, go. And they didn't do testing. They didn't do validation, right? Because, yes, upscaling does kind of work. It kind of works really well for lots of different environments. So what's different between the way Netflix is upscaling and Amazon is upscaling? Probably it's something on the back end. And if you're focused on just get it out there quick, I can see it turning into pretty crappy like that. But I think what you really need to do this right is you can't just throw the machine at it, but this is where human in the middle comes in. And you have to have artists involved. You've got to have, you know, testers involved. You've got to have people involved to make sure that the output is good. Don't just trust the AI.
Which is the case every time, right? Testing has a place in software development.
It's kind of important.
Yeah.
It's kind of important.
So we have another article that takes us down that exact same path, so to speak, as you're munching dots as a classic Pac-Man kind of experience. And this article from The Guardian talks about, hey, AI, pretend I'm Michael and I'm awesome at my programming experience and write for me a Pac-Man style game. And some of the examples that they show are actually pretty good. Many of them are pretty bad. So, okay, you would expect that because Pac-Man is a little bit different than Pong, right? So there's a lot of context to it that you need to be able to have. But for those people that are trying to, without being a programmer themselves, get an AI through multiple iterations to create a simple but complex game, it is still tricky. And my expectation is that we're going to see this evolve. We're going to see this emerge, and we're going to see this get to a spot where, shoot, you know, there is attempt number 7 looks an awful lot like the Pac-Man game that you maybe played, well, maybe not of all of our audience, but maybe you played, if you were in our audience, in the arcade once upon a time.
Well, so I had a slightly different reaction. Imagine that.
I thought you might.
Attempt number 7 was horrible. It looked fine, but it's not functional at all because Pac-Man is stuck in the wall.
Yeah, well, he's inside. Well, he's never going to get eaten by a ghost.
And a lot of the routes don't actually route correctly, but it looks good. Again, it's a perfect example of AI, right?
It's got power pellets. It's got all stuff.
The other thing that I found really interesting about this article was... This is Grok, I think, is the AI that's doing this, and it's touting, there is all this touting of how great Grok is and how they're going to open up a gaming studio using Grok-based games, and it kind of harkened back to last week's story about, you know, hyping a specific AI technology in order to drive hype around it, right? And so... here's an example. Oh, we can do games really easy. And look at great Pac-Man. And then you look at the details. Well, it's actually kind of crappy. And the people who are all getting excited about it are the AI bros on Grok. So I'm actually...
In all fairness, there's a reason to be excited, though.
Yeah. This one reminds me of the same as the Netflix one. It's kind of a halfway done job that's getting a bunch of hype and doesn't have the right QA in front of it.
Probably.
Do the QA.
So. Probably so, yeah, but again, the guy who wrote the article and took this crack at it is, you know, this is something that is, you know, not the full-time role. It's not the thing they're doing all the time.
Well, the 7 example or the 10 examples were not people. Him. They were other people.
Different people.
Right.
But are these people doing this as a full-time activity, or are they doing this as an experiment? And as an experiment, that's pretty darn cool. And it's moving in the appropriate direction is what I would say. Is it there? No. Mm. No.
Yeah, but I mean, come on. You know, if you're going to say you can create the game, and none of these are actually fully functional games. Not any of them. So,
well, Pac-Man is much more complicated than Pong or Asteroids or things like that.
But you got to but the thing is, like I said, you can't just accept it, you have to validate it. And that is not being done with these examples. So
yeah, we'll agree to disagree on this one. Now, moving on to the next one, this has been a long-term thing for the show, and the theme that we're seeing from the Boy Genius Report article around Claude is that it is playing Mario Brothers. So how many times, we'd have to count and it'd take a while to do it, so I won't do that because I'm lazy and I don't feel like it, but we have talked about this a lot of times where games have been used to test whether an AI can learn, do the machine learning, and can move things along. And I love the little example here where you could see how does GPT compare against versions of Claude and so on in playing Mario. And this is, or let's be specific, live Super Mario, right? And this is a way of now seeing how quickly an environment can learn and adapt and play the game, not write the game, but play the game. And then potentially, as we've seen with Qbert and some of the other examples like that, and other versions of Mario too, come to speak of it, because we talked about that, what, just a couple of weeks ago, find ways to complete a game that otherwise would have been impossible to complete because of programming bugs or, you know, other things. So I liked it just for that purpose.
So to kind of tie it all together,
yep.
This is how can you test the game, right? So if you
nicely put.
Created a crappy game, you run Claude against it, can it test it, and maybe you'll improve. It's setting up a GAN between your code generation and your testing of it.
Oh, that just puts a bow on it. Super Michael. I love that. Super Michael, not Super Mario.
Yeah, but I'm not going to hit my head against it, you know, a little metal thing to have coins fall out.
Now you might be a metalhead because you did find this particular article. I saw it too. I didn't look at it because I don't have a Vision Pro, and I'm also not as much of a metalhead either. But there are some intriguing things here for immersive concert experiences. So I'm curious to know, what's your take on the Apple Metallica experience?
Okay, first off, I'm not a fan of theirs. I just want to say that. And I'm not a metalhead, right? I like punk and I like rock. I'm not into heavy metal. I'm not into thrash. Okay? So, however, when I read the article, I was like, I look forward to seeing this. So I've watched it twice today.
And?
Okay. It's about 24 minutes long. It's three songs with commentary and some little video clips in between. And I will say, this is the best immersive concert experience that they've done on the Vision Pro to date.
Ooh. And why it's would you say that?
It's fantastic. Well, first, it doesn't have the intimacy problem that the other ones have, where you're like in a small enclosed room. This is the closing date of their latest tour in Mexico City. So it's a huge stadium. They had... The article will tell you, but I can't tell you how many cameras there were, but they were there, and they didn't try to hide them in the way they did with like some of the sporting events before the Vision Pro came out, right? Mm-hmm. The movement of the camera is appropriate. The interaction with the crowd was well done. The thing that got me was, so I put on my AirPods Pro, I put them in full spatial mode with noise canceling to kind of just immerse myself in it. It's 180 degree video, right? So you're not fully moving, but you can move full left and right and see what's going on around you. The point of focus is appropriate.
Okay. Yeah.
And you feel like you are at the concert. And there were little vignettes that you would catch in the crowd. And so the way the stadium was set up, it's one of these donut stages, right? Mm-hmm. And in the center of it, they've got crowd in the center and the crowd all the way around and then up into the stands, right?
Okay, yeah.
And they've got big video screens because not everybody's on the floor, right? They've got multiple zip line cameras like they do in sporting events. Mm-hmm. They've got stationary cameras next to the drummer, at all the microphone placements, et cetera. And then they have a hand-carried camera that they use to follow the band into the stadium and to do some background shots before each song where they're like backstage and talking, stuff like that. So when you're in the show, I was at a concert for Aerosmith back in 2017, and I was literally right up against the stage. Right. And this was at a corporate business event thing and et cetera. So it wasn't like 80,000 people. It was probably 10,000 people. And the interaction of the singer and guitarist with the audience had that same feeling of being at the Aerosmith concert. And the surround sound that you get with spatial audio, it was phenomenal. Again, not a huge fan of theirs. But I could watch this a couple more times because each time I'm seeing little vignettes. There's one vignette that I thought was just perfect. Lead guitarist, he's at the edge of the stage, and you got the crowd sitting there, you know, kind of cheering back at him. And he sees this one guy who's like just going nuts. And so he starts interacting with the guy and kind of singing at him and screaming. The guy's screaming back. I mean, it's heavy metal. Right. And then he finishes up. He gets up and he turns. He starts walking back, and they keep the camera on the guy. And the guy turns to his girlfriend, and they're like high five. Then you see the guy just kind of break down, and he's bawling his eyes out for the experience. I mean, talking about the raw emotion. I mean, this guy was obviously a super fan, right? And the lead singer was interacting with him, and you get that little vignette. Mm-hmm. So really, really cool. Best seats in the house at multiple locations as they move around, etc. And then there's some flyovers of the crowd and stuff. Really well done. Now, there are a couple of minor negatives.
Pray tell.
So there, the camera placement at the drummer is he's got his kit, and the camera is a little bit back behind his left shoulder.
Okay. So you can see
and
the action.
The cymbal is a little bit in front of his left shoulder, and it's one of these giant cymbals. Crash cymbals, right?
Yeah.
And when they showed that angle, I mean, there's other flyover cameras and zooms and all this other stuff. The 3D effect of the cymbal is a little bit disorienting because you're too close to that cymbal. Right? And there was one thing, and I didn't see it on the second watch through, and I kept trying to look for it, but in the first watch through, I saw an edit issue, I thought, where they showed the band on stage, and as they were panning, you could see on one of the big screens the lead singer singing, but he wasn't singing on stage. And that was an edit in the stadium, I think, problem, not a Vision Pro issue.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I think they have it right.
Yeah,
I think they have the experience right. This was nice. Highly recommend it.
So two questions. So first one, did the article talks about using Apple immersive video cameras. Were those cameras iPhones, or were they red cameras?
No. These are the professional cameras that they used at the sporting events.
Okay.
So they're about, from a Imperial system of measures, they're about a foot wide, about 8 to 10 inches high as a box with two giant lenses where they're capturing the light. And they were on either, like I said, on kind of a tripod stand next to the drummer. There were some on those pulley systems flying over the crowd, et cetera.
So the same ones sporting events. Okay.
Yeah.
So and they're Apple special immersive video cameras.
I would assume they are, or they could be the new Product Red ones. Not Product Red. I'm trying to remember the camera company. I thought it was Red.
I think they're is Red, and I think it might be.
And they
Sony
just
too,
announced or, one yeah. earlier in the year, so it could have been about the same time this concert was going. I don't know when this was actually filmed.
Okay.
But either way, it was not iPhones.
All right. So that helps, right? Because we know that iPhones can film in in immersive spatial. Video and spatial, but not necessarily to this fidelity. The second one is, and I'm curious to know if this was part of the experience or not. Did it feel more like a documentary because you were moving around from place to place as opposed to being in the best seat in the house and experiencing the concert from the best seat?
It was a concert film.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say a documentary, but they did do a little bit of talk, right?
Sense. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because it wasn't constant movement. It was long enough positioning in one place for you to experience that. But since it's a theater in the round, right?
Yeah.
It's the donut stage. If you had the best seat in the place, you don't have the best seat in the place for the entire show because the band is moving around on all 360 degrees, right? Except for the drummer, right?
It could be on a turntable. So.
He is, but he's not in the center because that's the crowd in the center, too. So he's on one arc of the stage, and they could turn him, but I didn't see them actually turn him. because it was three songs out of the entire show, but I think one was the very first song, one was the very last song, and one was the song somewhere in the middle. And one of the things I saw people online talking about, they would pay the full amount of a concert ticket to see the whole concert in this manner. And well, that's important.
Yeah, well, exactly, because that'll actually drive the revenue that's needed to go and do this sort of thing.
Yeah.
The last thing is not a question. It's just something that kind of struck me as you're describing all of this. And the reason I asked that last question was for those in our audience that remember Dragon's Lair, this was a quasi-immersive game where you would choose what to do as the hero, and things would light up on occasion. So if you were going to go jump across the bridge might light up and you would be like, move the joystick over there to jump across the bridge. So I can imagine that there may well be ways of experiencing a concert or other types of events where you might want to just stay put, you know, and not be moving around and having a concert film experience, but having a concert experience. And there may be a way to combine both of those by providing the viewer the ability to, oh, there's something over there. There's a vignette. There's an opportunity. There's another way to experience the concert. I'll go over there, just like in Dragon's Lair. I'll jump over the bridge, or I'll smite the dragon with my sword. You'll get those kind of opportunities to make those moves.
So I don't know if you remember, but back in the day, that was actually a feature of DVDs. You used to have an option on DVDs to switch camera angles. Very few companies actually shipped DVDs with that enabled, but that was something you could do. I would think from a concert perspective, I think it would actually distract me more if I had options to jump around to other little vignettes. Because it's like at a concert, if I have to go to the bathroom, I really don't want to leave my seat and go back to the restroom, right? I want to stay there and enjoy the show.
No matter what. Yeah, so
not no matter what.
you and I both watched Lord of the Rings together, and we know how long a movie gets when you get the big gulp. But I would say, you know, okay, let's take that user story into account. And all right, for you don't want to be notified that if you go look over there, you can see the guy rocking out and getting sung to. You don't need to even know that is occurring. You just let it rip. So you could turn on the ability to go and have those options, or you turn it off and just go with the flow.
It'll be interesting to see what they do if more people enable these.
Yes, exactly. All right, so we've rocked out, and now let's talk about like moving rocks, you know, or moving sheetrock. How about that from a Lowe's perspective, right? So North Carolina company Lowe's Home Improvement is expanding their pilot in a way that looks an awful lot like IKEA did back in the day to me. And I'm sure you've got thoughts about all of this.
Well, yeah. I mean, this pilot, I think they started it last summer at one store in Texas, and they're expanding it to more stores in Texas, which I found kind of interesting that it's not in North Carolina.
Austin. Go figure, right? That makes sense.
Yeah. I was really hoping that they would make this capability available in their Lowe's app that you can run on the phone or run on the Vision Pro, right?
Yeah.
Because I think we talked about this last summer when it was first announced. And the thing that would be great is to help, you know, we've been looking at some various remodeling over the years. And one of the toughest things for my wife is visualizing how things would look like in the house. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you can take and mirror what you're seeing on the Vision Pro on an iPad,
right?
I could actually design an entire room in the house with the Vision Pro on, and she'd be looking at the iPad and see it, which would be fantastic.
Yeah.
So why can't they enable this?
Well, they can. They just have it. Right. I mean, the LiDAR scanning, that's been around for a while, right?
Oh, yeah. And there's a cool app, and I almost bought it, but I couldn't justify it, for the Vision Pro that does real-time scanning of your rooms. And then you can do overlays like the Matrix. And what it's really great about is it has a persistence of memory while the app is running. It doesn't save it. Mm-hmm. You can walk through your entire house And then you would see your entire house fully in 3D. And one of the things, one of the people I was listening to talking about it, is he saw like misalignments between upstairs and downstairs to where he could run cables because of the fully immersive LiDAR-based scan of all rooms and halls and everything in the house. And so...
Nice.
That's really cool. So, yeah. Anyway, I'm excited to see the pilot expanding. I hope it expands to do-it-yourself at home, right? Lowe's is a home improvement do-it-yourself store, not a home improvement go into the store and have us show you everything manually ourselves for right. you store.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And you know, taking the examples of what you and the team did in Second Life as one, you know, yep. variation, and what IKEA has done for some of their design things. And gosh, what was it? One of the paint companies did something too, so you could visualize what the paint would look like on your wall if you change yeah. the paint color. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I think this is very much a home opportunity. Like, you know, shoot, there are examples too where you can scan your own body and you can see what different clothes might look like.
Exactly.
So I mean, like, why exactly. not? Those are things that shouldn't be come into the store, put on a headset, and you know, off you go. That could work a different way. All right. So we got a couple of articles here dealing yes. with some news about Pokemon Go. And the two articles that we've got, one of them deals with the price point that Niantic is selling the game Division for, and the other article deals with part of who's buying it and what does that practically mean, because the purchase of it is not just the ability to find the local Pokemon gym, it's also what's all the data that's around it.
Yeah, and what I found interesting, at least it was called out more in the first article from TechCrunch versus the 404 Media article, was that part of the investment is coming from Scopely, who are the makers of the Monopoly Go game. And we talked about this last week. Mm-hmm. and you know, the ability to capture all this data about local information and people traffic flow and everything else, whether it's from Monopoly Go or from Pokemon Go or some of the other games they're talking about, kind of makes it, what a bargain, right? Only $3.5 billion to buy this thing. And they only get $250 million in cash flow infusion to expand the gaming platforms. The other thing that I thought was interesting between the two articles is which was not part of the deal.
Oh yeah.
Ingress, yeah. Right? The original game. Mm-hmm. So it's one of these deals where it's like trying to understand all the nuances of why do you sell all the games, you sell the data with the games, right? So there's obviously strong value in the data that's being purchased by the buyer. You are infusing cash to grow the games, but for some reason you're not selling the game that started it all. And does that mean what they're selling doesn't include all the technology, right? So it's one of these stories that, to me, drove more questions than answers.
Yeah. Well, it's what do they want it for is really the, yep. the bigger thing. And last week's article, not just about Monopoly Go, to me is much more around the Scaniverse piece.
Yeah.
Right.
And they call out Scaniverse in the first article from TechCrunch also, right?
Yeah, because that was what we kind of really dug into first last week. And to me, that is very much a collection of information that people will go out with their phones and say, oh, here's an interesting sculpture, or here's an interesting, you know, site or facility or. And that could be gamified much more in a way into the future, like you could see in some of the other apps that we've used for a while, like Foursquare and other mapping related apps as well, to collect more real-time information about the world around you, and leveraging that value in a way that hasn't been done before.
Well, not only that, and the key that you mentioned there is the gaming aspect is currency of the data, right?
Yeah.
So if you believe that there's something going on in a certain area, you might do an in-game event that causes a lot of people to rescan the location.
Sure, sure. And in doing so, now you've got all the detail you wanted, and you've done it essentially for free, because all you had to do is get points or stars or whatever,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this is an intriguing way of leveraging your gaming population to do some fun stuff. So sticking on the gaming population, and I don't recall, this may have come from Andy.
It did.
Yeah, I thought it did. There's a Polygon article that talks about the Dungeons & Dragons Unreal-powered virtual desktop. And I've got feels about this, and I suspect you do too. So I've gone first the last couple of times. So what did you take away from this conversation, this article?
Yeah, so this is interesting. I actually looked at there's a link to a video that came out, I guess, mid last year of what this thing could look like. Mm-hmm. And then the article itself kind of says, you know, it's kind of there, but not really there. And if you try to do everything, it's kind of horrible. To me, what was interesting was the way they pitched the whole thing and the way they describe a lot of it kind of remind me to them being fully engaged in the vision that we had for virtual world experiences in 2008. And all the hype around it, right? Mm-hmm. And back then, it had a long way to go. And they are right exactly where we are because they've got a long way to go to get done, right? It kind of ties back to our first story on Siri, too, of you have this great vision, and you hard. Might have a long way to go, right? But I did find it interesting that the space that they developed and the way that you can kind of design your own tabletop experience for the dungeon or whatever, and the fact that you can use it for collaborative dice rolling was probably good enough for 80% of the use case right now. Uh-huh. And so if you want to play Dungeons & Dragons with a group of friends and you're no longer co-located, right? Maybe you want to get together with your old college friends who used to play D&D all the time, and you could do it remotely, I say go for it. And the experience that Andy and Epred and I have had with a similar game, Demio, which is a tabletop, virtual world, Dungeons & Dragons-y type game, was fantastic. So I think they have something here. It's not perfect, and it may be good enough. Now, I don't have a subscription at the master tier level to actually play their game that's now available. So what did you think?
This was a variation on the theme that we covered recently too, which is how am I going to apply digital techniques to an existing game where you didn't need the digital techniques to play it? So you might argue, well, okay, well, we're remote, right? So wouldn't it be cool to visualize a common dungeon or cityscape or, you know, room in a castle or something like that? And the answer to that is, of course it would. However, having grown up and played Dungeons & Dragons, you didn't need that. You needed pencil and paper and some dice, and that was
it. We never did the tabletop. That's right. We never played with little minifigs or drawing out maps. We all sat around a room. We had our dice and our character sheets.
Yes, exactly. I had some lead figurines, world. But I did not paint them. And shoot, I had one that had like a bow, and the bow got bent and, you know, broke, yeah. You know, because there's a little lead figurine, you know. So,
yeah.
Do you need these things to play? No. Is it going to enhance your playing experience? Maybe. There's a whole lot to be said for this game is a game about imagination. And it's often been said that when you read a book or you watch a movie, the book is the more immersive experience because it engages your imagination. And the movie, to use some quantum language for a moment, collapses reality into something that's observed. And it's observed because the director and the lighting designer and the sound designer and all those people did their things, their magic, in order to make the world appear to you in the way that they wanted, as opposed to the way your brain operated. So that was the biggest thing that I took away from all this is like, yes, this is hard too, right? This is a hard thing to do. And there's some coolness there. I don't debate that for a minute, but do you need it? Maybe not.
Yep.
Now,
but it does look cool.
It does look cool. Well, and this next thing looked really cool too, right? This Power Network Tycoon. This was a game that I had not encountered before. I watched a little bit of the playthrough around it, and it seemed pretty cool about a SimCity type experience where the big focus is on you need to power your city in order for it to grow, which is part of SimCity too. You know, you have to build plumbing and power and stuff like that.
What? So what's interesting about it is it's supposedly the guy who designed the game is a power engineer. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those simulations that goes probably too deep, right? Which is great if you're into those types of level of simulations. I did download the trial demo because it's available on Steam. It runs on the Mac fine, and the UI. Reactiveness was a little wonky, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, the purpose is the simulation, not necessarily the UI. But it did look okay, and I played about 10 minutes, and I had a good enough time to say I'm not going to buy it, but good job.
Yeah, I mean, there are aspects of it like the tornado, for example, that comes and destroys some of the power, lines and such. It's like, okay, it's kind of very pixelated, but you know that's okay. You know, it's a tornado. You didn't need to spend a lot of time developing the imagery around a tornado and testing it. Go back to the testing. So some fun aspects. I didn't realize that particular point, but it makes Well, he says it right at the top. I'm a power engineer, right? So there you go.
But the last thing, talking about power.
Yes.
I think this one had to be for you. And when I looked at it last night, there was one left. So did you buy it?
No. I have so much clutter on my desk right now. I'm playing with my little Lego Dalek. And, you know, I've got stuff and things. And my sousaphone mouthpiece is like, this will be fun and nice. But I don't need another dust collector necessarily.
And massive light up die 20,
and not at $250 either. I mean, that's another that's another piece. You'd have to roll a lot of 20s in order to say it's worth $250. Yeah.
There's still one left in stock. I just checked again.
Well, yeah, I
see. So 24 hours later,
one left in stock.
Yeah, because it's probably one that they made at $250.
Yeah, it could be. Well, if you want this dice.
Yes.
Or die. And let's be specific. Could either A, join us over at the show notes on gamesatwork.biz and you can click on the link and get it. Or maybe B, maybe you want to fabricate one of your own and maybe we'll hawk it here on the next edition of gamesatwork.biz. So until then, we'll say see ya till next week.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.